Welcome to the Sermon Podcast of Redemption Church. The following sermon is by our pastoral resident, Scotty Miser.
They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not grow faint. Gary has referred to the book of Isaiah's extreme quotability before, so I'm guessing most of us have heard that passage before in some context, run and not grow weary, walk and not grow faint. Can anyone remember a place where they heard that verse? Like, was it the slogan of your soccer team?
Remember the Titans.
Remember the Titans. Okay, fantastic. I forgot that about that movie. Yeah, and it is a fantastic sports verse because running and not growing weary is a good superpower to have if you're playing football. I think we also hear it in the worship song. Some of you may remember, you are the everlasting God. You will not faint, you won't. Yeah, so God's awesome at football too. But like Gary said before, Isaiah's quoted so constantly. Most of us have at least some knowledge of this book's words. And what I want you to see today, if you take away nothing else, is that this passage has meaning over and beyond the sports field. It still can have meaning on the sports field. I'm not here to take that away from you, but it doesn't have to stay there. Isaiah's poetic prophecy here is reminding an exiled people of God's love and power. But it does so in a way that I think can serve as a reminder for all of us in all times. Because it actually gives a really, really practical exercise that when life overwhelms, we can always look up. And I don't just mean that like esoterically, like spiritually, look up, look unto the Lord. No, like physically, walk outside and look up. And you can be reminded of God's great power and love. So as Gary said in his previous sermon, Isaiah 40 starts a section of the book that speaks to a people in exile. The people have been brought out of their homeland and into a place of oppression, alienation, and idolatry. And for the past 70 years, the people have been in this land of Babylon, far away from home, and they've heard basically nothing for the past 70 years from God or his prophets. And this silence might not seem all that significant to us, because I haven't consulted my local prophet for words of comfort in my exile lately, but I think it takes on a lot more significance, this silence. 70 years, when you realize how the ancient Near East thought about religion. So I'm going to take a brief dip into an ancient Near Eastern religion course, okay? Babylonians were not about to deny the existence of the God of Israel. The Babylonians, the Philistines, the prophets of Baal, none of them would have ever said that the God of Israel, that Yahweh, doesn't exist. To them, Yahweh would have existed as one of many place-specific gods. So the Philistines have their god, the Babylonians have their pantheon, we got a whole bunch of gods going on, and how do you know which one to follow? Not based, says the ancient Near East, not based on which god exists, but based on which god has the biggest muscles, which god is currently on top. And how do you figure that out? If you want to know which place-specific god was the most powerful in the ancient Near Eastern religion, all you had to do was look at which place was doing the best. And you see this referred to in texts regarding the prophets of Baal and the Philistines. The Philistines didn't do too well in that last battle. Well, Dagon must be having an off day, or the Philistines didn't sacrifice enough to Dagon. It's this constant power play between the gods. And the God of Israel, in the mind of the world at the time, was just another player on the chessboard. And after 70 years of silence from the God of Israel, 70 years of being surrounded by this mindset, of bringing up children in this mindset, being surrounded for 70 years by the temples of the Babylonian gods, where gods like Marduk and Ishtar were thought to have their literal physical presence in these temples. They were literally living down the street. It would be tempting to agree with the idea that Yahweh must just be having an off season. Yahweh is another player on the chessboard. Yahweh's the God of Israel, but we haven't been in Israel for a while. And we, the people of Israel, must be outside his domain for 70 years of silence. What this poem says to these people is no. God still got you. It says, look up. God asked the people of Israel, do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood since the earth was founded? He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. He goes on to say, lift up your eyes and look at the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls forth each of them by name, because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. In this poem, God's pointing out the thing that makes him different. God's saying, no, I don't live down the street in a temple, because this is my temple. I stretch out the sky for my roof. This is my tent. And as long as you're under this sky, you are still under my roof. You are still my people, and I still see you. After 70 years of silence, God says, look up. I've still got you. So this is one way in which the ancient Near East actually doesn't need much translation. We probably don't understand the religious structures of the ancient Near East very well, but the sky is still just as big. Like, we still have a thing hanging over us that is so large, the best word we've come up for it is outer space. How much of a non-descriptor is that? It's just like, yeah, it's the big, it's the rest of it. And one way in which we may actually have an advantage over the ancient Near East is that we've gotten a lot better and we've put a lot of energy into looking up. I'm going to pass around these pictures. And as we pass them around, I want to tell you the story of what it is. Because the picture doesn't actually look very impressive. You're probably going to look at that and think that I misprinted it. But no, that's a real black square with a red stripe that we spent a lot of money taking. So how do we get that picture of a black square with a red stripe? Well, in 1972, going. The ancient Near East got no reaction, but I said 1972, and Scott was like, whoa. Go really far back. In 1972, we sent out a satellite called Voyager 1, and we tasked it with the job at looking up. At a very specific part of the sky, we tasked it with circling Jupiter and taking as many high-definition pictures of Jupiter as we could get. The pictures of Jupiter that Voyager 1 took are astonishing. The picture I just gave you is not a picture of Jupiter. Because in 1990, 18 years after we sent it out, Voyager 1 had made it 3.7 billion miles away from Earth. And it was just about to leave the solar system for the first time. So the scientists got the bright idea, what if we take a selfie? What if while it's out there, 3.7 billion miles away, we get it to look back and snap a quick one of us? So on February 14th, 1990, we took that picture. That red stripe you're looking at is actually just a glare of sunlight off of the camera lens on Voyager 1. The picture of Earth is that white dot that you see in the red stripe. Earth, in the original image, takes up less than one pixel on this picture that the Voyager took in 1990, 3.7 billion miles away. This pale, whitish, bluish dot. Carl Sagan wrote a whole book about it. He wrote a whole book about the planet called The Pale Blue Dot. And he had this to say. He said, look again at that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, economic doctrines, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. And he goes on to say, think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. How does this make y'all feel? I think it should make us feel a little small, and I think it should shake our faith in a place-specific God. I think it should shake our faith in a God that requires the movements of specks on top of speck in order to exist. But I don't think that it has to shake our faith in a God that cares for us. I'm going to go back to those verses. Why do you complain, Jacob? Why do you say, Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, my cause is disregarded by my God? Do you not know, have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not tire or grow weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. God points to the skies in these passages, not as a way of making us feel unloved or uncared for. It's quite the opposite. God actually points to the absurd largeness of the universe to remind his people that their problems are not too much for him. The struggles of exile are not too much for the God who stretches out the heavens like a tent. So I want you to take that with you, because I think if you just look at the sky and you hope to find yourself in the center of it, if you just look at a lot of pictures of space and hope to find your particular belief system inscribed upon the walls of the universe, you'll likely feel very disappointed, and you'll likely feel very alone. But that's why we have passages like this. If you look at the sky with the idea of a loving, all-powerful God behind it as a foregone conclusion, I think you'll begin to realize that your problems are not too much for him. The struggles of exile are not too much for the God who stretches out the heavens like a tent. So this isn't actually the only time that God exercises this particular metaphor, that God calls this particular practice upon his people. He does it for Jacob. He does it for Israel. But he tells someone else to look up. He tells Jacob's father's father, Abraham, to look up. when Abraham needs his imagination stretched for what God can do. In Genesis 15, God says to Abraham, "Look at the heavens. So shall your offspring be. Count the stars if you can, because that's how many I'm going to make out of you." So what would this say to the people in exile? I think it would hyperlink back to God's promise to Abraham. I think it would remind them of the last time God used the sky to make a promise. And I think it would remind them that they're under the same sky Abraham was under. They're under the roof of the same God everyone is under. God says, "This is my roof. I made these. I call them by their name. What do you think I'm not able to do for you?" I'll close things up with a personal story, and then I want to open us up for a little bit of discussion. I felt particularly powerless these last couple weeks. I recently discovered that on top of all the other medical stuff I've got going on that you'll be familiar with if you've listened to more than one sermon or hung out with me for more than 10 minutes, on top of all the other physical stuff, I found out I have a hernia. And I'm in the middle of scheduling surgery for that. So I say that, I covet your prayers. this is a way of me like kind of hogging the spotlight of like, hey, me, think of me. But when I start to feel powerless, I tend to not go telescopic on my feelings. I tend to go microscopic. I tend to like find a book that I know is makes me feel good, or listen to a podcast that I know will numb my emotions for a while, and I just kind of hunker down and wait for the panic to pass. And recently I was doing that. Recently I was listening to an audiobook by Frederick Buchner called Crazy Holy Grace. And he was talking about the underlying, unchanging, overwhelming grace of God that he had seen in his own life. And I was listening to it, and I was listening to it, and I was hunkering down, and I was staring at my sneakers, and I was walking by the Delaware waiting to believe it. And then I got distracted by this flash of light. I thought people were taking photographs. I got distracted by this flash of light, and I looked up. I paused Frederick Buchner, and I looked up, and I saw lightning. Unobstructed, huge view of the sky, and lightning just illuminating the night, silently. There was no rain, there was no thunder, there was just this quiet, hushed, incredibly powerful light show going on in front of my eyes. I looked around to see if anyone else was noticing this. There seemed to be some people gathered at the pier. They were doing the same things I did. They were like holding up their metal rectangles and trying to capture the boundless sky within the frames of the metal rectangles so they could show them to whoever wasn't there. And in that moment, watching the lightning silently crackle, millions of jolts of energy just illuminating my particular corner of the tent, I felt extremely powerless and somehow extremely seen. Extremely known. I felt in some religious, maybe superstitious way, I felt God saying, "I've got this. I've got you. I'm here whether you see it or not. You're under my roof." And in that corner of the pale blue dot, I felt I was exactly where God wanted me. Would you stand with me? And if you're able, grab your little picture. Look at that cosmic absurdity. Why would anyone care about that? God does. If you'll sing with me. He's got the whole world in his hands. 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 Lord, stretch our imaginations for where you are and what you can do. Stretch our imaginations as you stretch the heavens out like a tent every night. Call us by name as you call the stars, and keep us always never too busy to look up. Amen.
To find out more about Redemption Church, visit redemptionbristol.org.